Hey everyone, I'm Rob Lee, and this is Beloved Journal. It's a podcast centered around the radical idea that we should love and be loved in more than just a romantic capacity. My co-host, Mandy McDowell, and I seek out people we have come to admire or wish to know more about and talk about their hopes, their dreams, their challenges, and how they deal with their despair. All of this is through the context and lens of loveliness. The poet Galway Kinnell said that sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness. If you need to relearn or reshape your conception of love and the abundance therein, this podcast is for you. Hey everybody, this is Rob Lee for Beloved Journal, coming to you during a week that has been hectic, filled with upheaval, disunity, and discord, with the apparent overturning of Roe versus Wade, the landmark case that gave abortion rights nationwide. I had a friend who said, well, this doesn't change much for me, but it changes a lot for a lot of people. And that sentiment is true for many of us. We are in places of privilege. Myself, I'm a man. I don't need reproductive freedom because we don't make that part of the legislation. I don't know the answers to these. These aren't easy answers that we're seeking right now. But luckily, I know someone who has some good answers and some good perspective on this. So today we are going to hear from my friend and colleague, Tori Williams Douglas. Tori is a anti-racist activist. She is a podcaster. She is a thinker. She's an educator. And she works to educate all of us at the intersection of race, class, politics, reproductive freedom, reproductive health, religion, the list goes on. So without doing her a disservice by belittling anything and missing anything, I want to go ahead and turn it over to our interview with her. Let's listen in. Tori, thank you so much for coming on Beloved Journal.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to have a conversation.
So we've been wanting to have you on this podcast for some time now, and the stars finally aligned. And the stars finally aligned on the day after that news had leaked from the Supreme Court, which I didn't know Supreme Courts leaked, but apparently they do leak this information. About Roe v. Wade, about Roe being overturned, this landmark civil rights decision or abortion case decision that was held in... either in the 1970s, 7-2, it wasn't a controversial decision.
It wasn't contentious, really.
Right. It has since become very contentious. And this is part of kind of the conversation that you're in right now, is talking about rights, not only for people of color, but across the board. What are we facing right now in our country, and how can we come to it with any sense of dignity and hope for what's to come when, as we were talking before we started recording, the world seems to be ending for some people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it really does come down to the fact that, like, hope is not like this wishy-washy, oh, things will get better, or even like, I'm going to put on my pink pussy hat and go, you know. It's like, this is something that you have to cultivate. And alongside that, like, kind of cultivating, doing work beyond just protesting, right? Like organizing. I mean, it really does in so many ways feel like the world is ending. You know, and it's just, we just kind of keep getting slammed with one thing after another, like you talked about, when we were talking about before we started recording. And it's a lot, you know, it's a lot to have to contend with. And, you know, we both have kids, so I still have hope for the future, and I'm still going to keep showing up because of them. Right. Even if I don't feel like I'm necessarily going to see like any of the benefits of that. But yeah, I mean, like Roe specifically has just become this, I don't know, like animating, target, I suppose, goal of folks on the right. And you know, that's how I was raised. I was raised by anti-abortion activist, and who like worked with Phyllis Schlafly, among others. And this was like what I was raised to be, one of these people that was creating, I guess, this policy, this pushback against Roe, right? I was born into like that particular culture war, right? A product of that. And God, it's like there's just, it's hard because it's like we've been saying this for many decades now. It's like this is what they want to do. Like they're not even hiding it. You're just not paying attention. Yeah. So I'm hopeful that like this will animate people in a way that maybe we haven't seen up till now. I don't know what that even looks like, considering the fact that, you know, like we had massive global protests when George Floyd was murdered, you know, and that was less than 2 years ago still. It's hard to know what's really gonna move the needle, which, you know, again, it's like, okay, I have to keep showing up. I have to keep having hope. I have to keep doing the work.
It's hard to ask for like hope, I guess. That's a hard question to ask for me to ask, right? Because I'm a white man. Yeah, like I'm a white man who. But you did write this incredible article that we'll link to in the show notes. You wrote it in 2019.
Yeah,
and it talks about your journey from becoming a pro. What you were, as you said, you were raised to be a pro-life activist. Mm-hmm. And then you suddenly have this turn in your life to become more pro-choice. And your life is, at least as I know you, is so varied in a lot of different ways that you're living out life. But this way particularly fascinated me this week to see that article that you tweeted out. Why don't you talk a little bit about your journey from where you were initially cultivated to be to where you are now?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I was raised in like white evangelical spaces. Spaces also where you couldn't be like a Christian and a Democrat, right? So there were a lot of just these really hard lines drawn in the spaces where I was raised. And so from the time I was really, really young, I was being given a lot of anti-abortion propaganda in terms of like literally like reading materials, newspaper articles. I remember my mom like showing me this very weird kind of panel of diagrams of what they were calling partial birth abortion. And I was single digits when my mom is like showing this to me. And so I really sincerely was like, you know, life begins at conception or somewhere around there, right? And I was very much about this like, oh, it's a person with a heartbeat. It's not technically a person with a heartbeat. Like, whatever.
Acts don't matter as much in that scenario, right?
No, like, you know, they really don't. They really don't. It's the emotional piece of it that is like really animating here. Because it's like, there's very little that will make people more upset than killing babies. Like, how are you going to find something more upsetting than that? I grew up in all of this. I really sincerely thought I was like, even if I stop being a Christian, I'm pretty sure I'm still going to be like pro-life. Right. Cause that's still calling it that back then. And when a really big like switch for me in that process was actually getting pregnant, because my pregnancy with my first was just brutal. And I was like, there's no way, like I had a really decent support system, right? I had okay health insurance. I had a supportive partner, and I was like, this is hell on earth. Like sick all day, every day, from the moment I wake up until I fall asleep. And, you know, I was crying myself to sleep because I didn't want to be alive anymore. That's how sick I was. And I was like, I get this now, right? This is very much like, it's very much like man finally has a daughter and there's like, oh, women are people too. Like, it was one of those, right? I'm not proud of this revelation that I had. Like, it finally took me being pregnant, but I was like, there's no way to do this without a support system, right? Because I can barely do it and I have one. So that was a really, really big turning point for me personally. I still was really concerned, honestly, about like fetuses experiencing pain and like trauma, right? Because that's another thing, is they're like, it's like the heartbeat thing at 6 weeks, which is, you know, again, that's not what that is happening there. And then like, yeah, it's like a fetus can feel pain like 18 weeks or something. It's like, not those brain structures don't even exist. They're certainly not connected. That's not a real thing that's happening, but I had to do a lot of research. And thankfully I had, a friend who I met at church. And then like, I think her second time coming to church, the person who was speaking had said something anti-queer or like transphobic. And, she was like, yeah, no, I'm not doing this, and just like left. So, right. So we like met once at church, and then like, that's when we became friends, and she was just out, like she was done. But she worked in a neuroscience lab. And so when I had questions about stuff, when I had questions about fetal development and brain development, and like, was trying to work through all of this propaganda that I've been given, thankfully, I really appreciate the fact that like Michaela was actually willing to answer the questions that I had and like took them seriously. And yeah, so I definitely made like a hard left, I guess, in terms of bodily autonomy and people being able to get pregnant, not being forced to stay pregnant. I think we treat pregnancy like it's a side gig situation, you know, and it's not. You're 3D printing a person. Like, that is not a side gig. That is like your entire day, every day. The overwhelming amount of your energy expenditure is that. So yeah, it did take me way too long, but I'm now very much at the point where I'm like, no, this is labor. Like, this is work. This is something that, contrary to what capitalist economists think, it's like, this is something that provides value, like literal value to like society. So you have like, if this is so sacred and this is like so important, and also like, oh, it doesn't matter if you don't have health insurance or whatever, you can just pay out of pocket the tens of thousands of dollars that it costs to give birth in this country, which is ridiculous. And it's just like, oh, well, you know, just get pregnant and you keep living life. It's like, that's not how this works at all. Like, it's your entire body has to change in order to like keep from rejecting this foreign object, right? And so, yeah, I really kind of grew into this position of being very adamantly pro bodily autonomy over kind of a short period of time, given how brainwashed I was. Like, I don't like use, that's one of those words, is like gaslighting. Like, it's a real thing, and also it gets used a little too frequently, I think.
No, but in fairness, this was something that was going on for you. Like, you were inculcated into that culture in such a way, mm-hmm. that you were not expected to leave it ever. And mm-hmm. then for you to leave it is a big step. And, you know, in a lot of ways, your life has been leaving those spaces and going into new ones. I mean, with your mm-hmm. podcast, with your deconstruction in your faith life, whatever that looks like, you know, like whatever you want to call it anyway, you know, your whole yeah. life has been this journey of leaving something that you felt comfortable with and not certain of, but maybe concrete at least, and into something that was different and more. And just a nuanced approach, maybe to some of the ways you're handling things. And that's one of the things I want to talk about too, is your podcast. I mean, what you're doing is so important. It's kind of a primer for folk who maybe may not know how to talk about issues of importance surrounding race and civil rights and the ability to have these conversations. What got you started with that? And why were you like, gosh, I need to help people who may not have the conversation tools that they need or want or are privileged enough to go about their lives without, you know, like how did you get into that space of like, I have to do this not only for my own sanity, but for helping others as well?
So that really was kind of a byproduct of being in these like hard right kind of religious spaces. Because I saw people online and like was having conversations, because this, you know, most of this was before the pandemic, when we could actually talk to people IRL, about like, is like seeing all of these ridiculous arguments that people were using to try to like address anti-choice rhetoric, just as an example, right? To address race and racism. And I was like, this isn't effective, right? Like they don't care about the things that you're saying. Also, like they're going to like dismiss anything that you say out of hand if you don't have receipts like ready to go. Again, like things have changed a lot in the last 10 years. For sure. I mean, I would say since Obama was elected, things have changed a lot. But that being the case, I was like, no, we have to have a conversation about like the right ways to like have these conversations. Because it's like we're not taught any of this in school, contrary to the rhetoric currently. Like nobody is taught racism in elementary school. like that's not a course that's being taught to children, unfortunately. So for me, it was just like, oh, these are things that I'm interested in, right? Like I'm interested in American history and sort of, you know, like have these sort of spectrum-y traits, I suppose, of being able to like memorize like dates and times and things. And also having a brain that really likes to sort of pull a bunch of different ideas together and kind of, excuse me, and to kind of explain like how these things to explain that like we're not dealing with like every little issue is like in its own vacuum sealed container, which is kind of how we're taught US history. You know, we're not taught about the ways that these fights for civil rights and access and accessibility, like we're not taught about how these things all bump up into each other and bleed into each other, right? So for me, I ended up using Twitter kind of as this tool, kind of be like, you guys, there are better ways to talk about this. There are better ways to have these discussions. You know, we have, and like, you know, we're not public school. Like nobody's being taught about power analysis. Right. So we have to have conversations about that, which, I mean, that wasn't even a thing that anyone taught me about. Like that wasn't something that I even necessarily read about so much. It was like, oh, this is my lived experience, right? So like I can say something to a person and like if a white dude comes up right behind me and says the exact same thing, like it's different because he said it, right? It has more weight because he said it. And so kind of giving people like this framework, like a new framework to use to analyze like the world and these arguments that are being made. Right. It's like, statistically, you're not likely to be murdered by a police officer. Like, okay, that's not really helpful. Like, I'm just like, yeah, statistically, you weren't very likely to be lynched either. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. That doesn't make it okay. That doesn't mean that we just keep going with the way things are. Like, that's a problem still. Like, the statistics don't really matter. I think especially with like political violence, right? And so I really enjoy talking to people. I really enjoy educating people, and I really enjoy giving people tools that they can use, right? Not just like, you're a bad person and you should feel bad. Like, you know, if you're like fascist adjacent, like, you are a bad person and you should feel bad about yourself. But most people are not that. Like, most people think of themselves at the very least as good people who are not actively trying to be racist or sexist or like transphobic or whatever the situation is. But also like don't have the language to not be that, right? Like the script that we're given culturally is all of those things. And again, we're not taught to like critically analyze any of that. And so, yeah, I've been able to use Twitter to kind of communicate that, and that kind of turned into what I wanted to do with Twitter, because I had used it to start raising money to do kind of like mutual aid stuff for like Black women on Twitter, was kind of like what I had started with. And I grew up in poverty. Like, I grew up really, really poor, and you know, my dad was always working like two or three jobs, and we were still barely scraping by. And so I was like, I really want to be able to help somebody else who's in that position, right? Like, somebody like their kids now, obviously, who are experiencing the exact same childhood functionally that I experienced. And so I was like, I want to be able to mitigate that. And so I decided to start my podcast, White Homework, because I wanted to have a platform to be able to like raise money to essentially help families of color like pay their rent every month. Because I remember what a big deal it was if like my parents had like one month where they didn't have to pay rent. Like, that was huge. And, you know, like just the amount of stress in our household was so much lower. And so I was like, okay, I need some kind of a vehicle to do this, because, you know, as much as people are absolutely willing to show up, if you just randomly get on Twitter and like ask and say, hey, like, somebody here needs help, like, let's like help them out, like materially help them out. But yeah, so the reason that I started the podcast is because I was like, well, I'm doing all this educating anyway. I want to be able to use it to help people who are financially struggling, just because of like in my family, these kind of systemic issues that as an individual you have no control over, that just leave you in a really bad place. So that is kind of, that's why I started the podcast, really, was because I wanted to like help people pay rent. And, you know, kind of using the things that I found really fascinating, you know, like American history and kind of like sociology and neuroscience, and kind of pulling those things together to create like tools that people could use to kind of do their own analysis. Yeah. So that was my motivation there, was it was like, I can use this random skill that I've developed to help people, like, to help make people's lives easier.
Right. And I mean, you know, it's been met with success, and you're doing a great job there. I continue to wonder, though, like, and maybe this isn't a fair question, but like, what's the end game for all of this? Like, where are we headed to as a country, as a world? I mean, everything seems to be breaking apart, falling down. I don't want to ask you where is your hope, but where can we go, and what can we do to be agents of change in a moment like this? Since your specialty is kind of helping people find those resources and those outsources by which we're able to do things constructively, You know, whether it's abortion rights or, you know, helping with indigenous folk or black and brown folk or queer folk, whoever, whatever our issue or personhood is, where can we go and what can we do together to start this conversation forward? Because we're going to have to go forward whether we like it or not. We've got to move somehow. And oftentimes it feels a little crazy moving pieces all at once, you know, moving different factions all at once. But I think if we move together, we're far better off than if we're trying to move in disparate, you know, portions.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I like that's very clearly the case that like there's a reason that organizing is a thing and like being a solo artist like trying to defend civil rights doesn't work great, you know, like we think about these civil rights leaders that kind of like stand on their own. I mean, you know, Malcolm X and MLK, and, but they had, there were hundreds and thousands of people who were supporting their work and like giving them, like helping them organize and giving them opportunities and spaces and the ability to like present these arguments. So yeah, I mean, I think that like honestly, like the work on the ground, like mutual aid, that ends up being kind of the most important work that's being done. It's definitely overwhelming. Like, you know, I get that. And there are days that I feel overwhelmed, just like everybody else, right? Like mental health is kind of a doozy in general.
That's another issue that I didn't even throw in there. Like, I mean, that's another thing, you know, another personhood and reality that I struggle with, that you struggle with, that.
Yeah.
I mean, so it seems as best to do the on the ground work that we're doing and just do it with fervor. And passion and continue to press forward.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, like there is, I mean, I do think that there's like there's something to be said for, you know, what extreme people with very extreme views on the right have done in terms of like just hijacking an entire political party and just pulling as hard to the right as you can get. You know, I think that there's maybe some merit to that approach, right? Like we all are going to have to figure out like what we can contribute. And I, you know, with white homework specifically, that was kind of why I created these little like white homework modules for people to do, is because I was like, I kept having people come to me and saying like, I agree with everything you're saying and I don't want to be racist. What do I do? I'm like, well, I don't know you, so I can't tell you what you specifically should do. Right. Like, I know my best friends, so I can tell them specifically what they should do, right? Because I know like their tax bracket and I know like whether or not their families can help them out consistently or not, right? I have information there. I don't know what kind of margin or bandwidth or skills or strengths that you have. So that is like personal work that we have to do in order to like show up and be like on the ground, making a material difference for like the most vulnerable people. I mean, that really is the starting point for me for everything, is like, who in this scenario is the most vulnerable? What are we doing to protect them? And, you know, to make sure that like their lives, livelihood, mental health, that there's some kind of like margin or bandwidth there. And I think that that's kind of the thing with white privilege specifically, is it's like, this is, white privilege can be spent. Like you can use that.
And use it for good in some ways. Yes. You know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The thing about using it though, is that you will have less. If you have actually used it, you will have less of it at the end. Which that makes people really scared. You know, I think that like our nervous systems are really weird, and your nervous system codes privilege as safety, right? So if you're losing your privilege, your body thinks that you are physically in danger because nervous systems are not rational. You know, it's like, it took us a really long time to evolve these like massive brains that we have. Like your nervous system is mainly running the show, and you know, you're not doing critical analysis with your nervous system. So yeah, there's definitely like some work to be done around that. Like looking at ways, like how can I show up? Like, where do I have margin? Where do I have the ability to be present? And like, you know, cause for a lot of people showing up in the street is not like, is not feasible for them. Right. I have a lot of like disabled and immunocompromised friends for whom like doing activism and organizing online is what they do. Right. Because that is what they have access to. And like you, I'm not letting people go like, oh, well, if you're not actually like showing up in the street, you're not doing the work. Like, that's just not true. Right. It's like, we all have a different amount of bandwidth. We all have a different amount of margin. We all have different amounts of privilege. So yeah, I, to me, like the focus is always harm reduction and protecting people, like the most vulnerable people. Right. And that does look like triage a lot of the time. You know, I think that we very frequently, we really want to have the trial, but the shooter's still got a gun in his hands. Like, that's not, we have to do things in the right order, right? You have to stop the bleeding first before you can go and like litigate whatever it is that you're trying to figure out. So understanding that, like, again, prioritizing harm reduction, we're prioritizing vulnerable people. And that doesn't mean like, oh, I'm protecting you. Like, I'm here to do that. It's like, no, people get to tell you what they need. Right. This isn't something where you come in and like dictate to people like, oh, this is, I can tell what you're experiencing. And like, it looks like you need this, that, or the other. It's like, no. Like when we're talking about prioritizing vulnerable people, and protecting them, it's what they say, right. It's what they say that they need. And so for me, at least, that's kind of where I tell everybody to start. And, you know, I am still hopeful that, like, you know, maybe we can make a material difference. And, you know, hopefully, again, like you said, making the world a better place for our kids.
So we ask everyone who comes on Beloved Journal, what or whom do you find easy to love?
So for me, I love that you're actually asking this right now, because Mother's Day is coming up, and so like my favorite thing to do is to like go on hikes with my kids. And they're, you know, they complain, but they're really troopers. And you know, I can take them on like 5 or 6 mile hikes, and they do really, really well. We're not fast. We're very slow. So we get
slow
past
and steady
on the
wins
trail.
The race kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
But, so for me, that is like, that's my favorite thing to do. That is what I do to kind of like, as much as I can to protect my own mental health. You know, being in nature gives your nervous system a lot of margin. And that's something that we don't talk about, I think, very often. We don't talk about enough, rather. Is just spending time outside. And, you know, I live in Portland, so it's not super frequent that we get to like sit outside and like look at the stars, because it's very frequently cloudy here. But, you know, that's something else that I do with my kids. That's just, you know, like stargazing in the summertime, or, you know, watching like the meteor shower or whatever the situation is. If we like get lucky and there's a comet going by, which I'm like, I love that stuff. And again, like that's something that like gives my nervous system margin. And I also get to like have this really kind of, these really beautiful moments with my kids talking about like how we have this immense value. And also,
We're really small.
Yeah. Like, we're very, very fragile creatures. I mean, for apex predators, we're rather weak. So, yeah, but those are the things that I love doing, and those are the people that I love doing them with.
Tori, thank you so much for coming on Beloved Journal.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
Beloved Journal is hosted by Rob Lee and Mandy McDowell. Our theme music is by Mipso, the best band in the world. The podcast was the vision and idea of Stephanie Lee, who continues to produce the show. And Frank the Poodle said I would be remiss if I didn't remind you to check out our website, www.belovedjournal.com.